The question was asked, if we find ancient ketubot, or they claim they found ancient ketubot that seem to incorporate a text that would help us with the plight of the Aguna, shouldn't we incorporate that, or why don't we, halachically, why hasn't Orthodox Judaism adopted that? So just to clarify a little bit, right, Aguna is a situation where a woman can find herself stuck, that she's married to a person, and then the person decides he's not going to fulfill his obligations as a husband to her, and at the same time he will not give her a get. He does not divorce her. So now, halachically, she's stuck. She cannot remarry, and she's not getting what she's entitled to as a wife. That's called an aguna, a woman who is stuck. Aguna traditionally was a woman whose husband disappeared off the face of the earth. He went on a business trip, never came back. We don't know what happened to him. So she cannot remarry because he might be alive and she doesn't have him around. She doesn't have her husband. But there are also instances where we know where the husband is. He's hiding out in New Mexico. He's living in the jungles of Africa or whatever. He's doing whatever he pleases. But he's not giving her the get. Our sages, traditionally, their discussion of aguna revolved around the woman who was stuck, the woman whose husband really disappeared. We don't know what happened to him. He went on a ship. The ship never landed. We don't know. Did he dock off at some land that we don't know about? We don't know what happened. And in those instances, our sages really traditionally did somersaults to try and find a way that a woman would not be stuck. It's a terrible situation that a woman has no husband, cannot remarry, and she's stuck. So we've always tried to find leniencies for this, and traditionally these were the questions that were posed before the greatest rabbis of the generation. The way you measure a rabbi traditionally is, was he a great rabbi or not, was, did he deal with the question of agunot? That's a way of saying, did he deal with the most weighty questions in halacha? Because it is one of those questions which, on the one hand, we want to be as lenient as possible, and on the other hand, you have to be really, really big to be lenient in this situation, because you're dealing with a situation where, if you're wrong, the kids are mamzerim, the kids are bastards, you caused the woman to sin in something which is, a person should rather die than sinning. So you're dealing with a very, very weighty situation. Of course, we do our best and we try to ensure that a woman does not get stuck. And of course, whatever means we have available, we are going to try to use to ensure that she doesn't get stuck. That being said, we are working within a framework of halacha. And halacha has specific rules. We know that there were Tanaim and there were Amoraim. And Amoraim did not argue on Tanaim. We know that Amoraim sealed for us the Gemara, and if we wake up today and say, well, I have a good reason why I disagree with the Gemara, we'll say, that's very nice, write it down in your notebook as a question, and in the time to come when Elio shows up, you'll ask him, how come the Gemara said this, even though to you you seem to have a different proof or a different understanding, a different way. We're entitled to ask questions. We're entitled to say, I don't understand, but that's totally different than changing halakha. And since the sealing of the Talmud, the Jewish people have accepted the ruling of the Talmud, and as such, the Talmud is binding upon every Jew as though the High Court of Israel has ruled this way. Just as if the Sanhedrin gave ruling, then we can't argue on that ruling. They were given the final word. They're the High Court. So too, the ruling of the Talmud is the final word, and we cannot argue on that. Now, there are also rules that evolved post-Talmud that aren't written explicitly, because the Talmud can't address what's going to happen 10 generations down the road, but generally the rabbis agreed that the Achronim, the rabbis from the 15th century onward, they were not on the level of their predecessors, and they would not argue on their predecessors. There's no written rule, 15th century rabbi cannot argue on 14th century rabbi. It doesn't say it anywhere. But the rabbis of the 15th century and the 16th century, 15th century is really the border, it's more the 16th century, those rabbis recognized we're not on the level of our predecessors. And that's why they got the nickname Achronim, the latter rabbis. And they gave the nickname of Rishonim to the previous generation. Now, we have rules as to how the halacha is defined. What is halacha? If we would find a manuscript that says you can write a ksuba in this way. And we would find 15 manuscripts that say they did that. Then before we would give any weight to these manuscripts, we would say, wait a second, but the Talmud tells us how we can write a ksuba. And we'd ask ourselves, does this fit into the halacha that we have from the Talmud? And if it does not, then we have no choice but to say, well, either this is an error, this is a forgery, we don't know what it is. But any manuscript you show me is not going to overrule what I have on tradition. I have the Talmud, and I'm not going to undo that because of a manuscript.
Is this specifically word for word in the Gemara, how to write a ksuba?
It does not say exactly word for word, but it says what has to be incorporated and what cannot be incorporated. So, meaning the Gemara gives us rules as to what should be written in the ksuba. And there are words that the Gemara tells us. We do have a custom to add certain words into the ksuba. We begin the ksuba by Nales Yerushalayim Aruch Simchasi, and we have certain words. There are certain parts of the ksuba that are written explicitly in the Gemara, and then the Gemara defines for us what may and may not be in the ksuba, what the ksuba is supposed to be. The Gemara, and then they're shown him, and then the halacha. And we do have a specific text that's quoted as to what should be in the ksuba. Now, there are slight variations that are okay, but at some point you say, wait a second, this is not in line with tradition. Whether something will be accepted or not, the first question we're going to ask ourselves whether it's accepted or not is, does this fit into halacha? You could bring me every manuscript in the world and I'll say, wait a second, I don't understand the manuscript. Maybe I don't understand how such and such a big rabbi has signed on the manuscript, and now I'm going to have to break my head over the manuscript. But at the end of the day, a manuscript is not going to change what it says in the Gemara. It's not going to change the halacha that we have. It might open our eyes and we'll say, hey, maybe we have to reconsider. What was the Heter Mechira? The rabbis in Yafo, before Rav Kook, were brought a manuscript from the 16th century in which their predecessors had figured out a way, a halachic loophole, to permit working and having produce in the land of Israel. So the rabbis said, okay, if we have this ancient manuscript, now we're going to figure out halachically how we could apply it. And working with the rules that we always work with, and working with the Talmud, they said, because I have this basis, because I know this was done, and I have a good source for this action, so now I'm willing to accept it. Rav Chaim Oizer, forgetting the name. I'll get back to it in a second. One of the chief rabbis of Europe, before he was willing to approve the Heter Mechira, he said, first I want to see the ancient manuscripts to see which rabbis approved it 400 years ago. Once he saw that, he said, okay, why? And this is where an ancient manuscript can be useful. He said, this is an innovative idea. And it has basis in halacha, but there's room to question that basis in halacha. There's room to look at it both ways. If I see that ancient rabbis approved it, so then I agree that we can approve it because of the rules of halacha. The rules of halacha alone I would not feel confident enough to take on my shoulders to say this. But if I see that others did it, and being that it fits into the rules of halacha, then I'm willing to approve it. I'm forgetting the name right now. Who it was that said that? I'll try to remember in a minute. That's where we might use it. So you're right that sometimes finding a manuscript, the rabbis will say, okay, if we have validated that this is really a true manuscript and big rabbis approved it in that generation, so then if it fits into halacha, then that will sometimes give us the necessary strength to approve it today in halacha. But to say that because I find the manuscript, now I'm going to overturn everything else in halacha, that we don't do. We still work with the same guidelines.
But if the manuscript is written before the Shulchan Aruch was written, then that argument on Achronim, if you machloket between Rishonim, you can take the position of a Rishonim. Even though it's not necessarily, if you have machloket between two Rishonim, if the ksuba was written before
That goes back to the first thing we discussed. That's not necessarily so.
I understand, but you can find that out. That's not the most difficult thing to find out when it was written, who was written by.
Oh, so that I'm not sure you're right about. If we find something, let's say, that the Rush approved, you have to find someone of that stature, then we'd have to think about it. It doesn't sound like anyone found anything like that. If you would find something that a Rishon of that stature approved, that this is correct, then we'd think about it. And even then, I think we would say what the Chazon Ish said and what we said, even the Mishnah Berurah seems to go with, that you're not going to change halacha that's been accepted for generations. But you're right, for an aguna we would definitely do somersaults, and this is something that the biggest rabbis of the generation would have to contemplate.
I've never heard anybody, I didn't do all the research. I just have never heard anybody rabbis doing this research on this thing, that they've just, my understanding, simply rejected it, and it seems almost political the reason they rejected it, because...
I don't think that's true. Check! I don't think that's true. He just gave you an example that Rav Berkovitz presented it to Rav Feinstein.
No, not in this case. It was this case, specific case.
I know it sounds like